Welcome to Dugout Study Hall, a remedial course in baseball stats and proud member of the Pitcher List Podcast Network. I'm your host and expert layman, Matt Goodwin, and I am joined, as always, by your fake baseball economist, Alexander Chase. On this episode, we talk a whole lot about rookies, rookie performance, rookie F-War, rookie buy-sell, and rookies. But before we get to all of that, Alexander, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. How about yourself, Matt?
Hanging in there. The school year ended this week, so I am officially on summer vacation, which when you have three little kids might mean something slightly different than when you don't, but at the very least, I have a nice reset button, clean slate, a chance to decompress from the end of the school year. That means something different for you, though, right? That means a complete change in your schedule.
Yeah. I have a class starting up pretty soon that I'll be teaching. And it's actually interesting. I get to talk about all these to all these kids, like, is summer vacation fun for you, for them? And some of them are like, yeah, I'm so happy to not be in school anymore. And others are like, actually, my parents have signed me up for so many camps that I'm overwhelmed and this seems worse. So it's fun to hear from both ends of that.
Well, there's a lot of pressure, I think, on parents. I'm not sure because I don't really give into it, but I think there is a lot of pressure on that. My kids are young. It's easy for me to not give into it. But I think there is a lot of pressure on parents to get their kids involved in all sorts of things. You know, they go to socialize, and what, your kid's not in 73 camps over the course of the summer. What's wrong with you? You're not giving them enough exposure. Meanwhile, we wonder why kids are loaded up with anxiety and can't figure their way out of a problem. There's so much going on, so much to do. Anyway, I'm not trying to parent shame anybody. Anybody who's doing what they think is in the best interest of their kid, your heart's in the right place. I got you. I understand. Sometimes we do what we think is best and it doesn't work out that way. So that's not a criticism of parents who are overscheduling their kids. It's just a notice thing. And then there's me, who probably way underschedules his kids, and they should probably be doing more. believe me, I'm not trying to disparage anybody. Summertime, at the very least, it's a nice opportunity for me to be able to. Most people don't get this, right? The opportunity to like just disconnect from work, whether it's whether like going to work during the day and coming home and dealing with your kids versus dealing with your kids all day long. We don't have to split hairs on which is more difficult. It's definitely nice to have one less layer of things to have to think about every single day, and more of an opportunity to get out on the golf course. So there's that.
Yeah, we don't have to have the golf discussion again or anything like that. No. But I know what you mean. I've talked to a handful of the parents who are like getting their kids set up, or, you know, I feel like 17-ish year old kids, you can be like, you know, is it because they want to get you out of the house, or is it because they're trying to like sign you up for stuff because they think you're gonna love it? And for the most part, you know,
a little from column A, a little from column B.
I feel like there's a healthy amount of both that I want for everyone. You know, if your parents aren't trying to get you out of the house when you're 17 years old, something up is definitely up, right?
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, listen, every situation is different, but 17-year-olds should be like thinking about how active they want to be in certain things for their college applications and essays and making themselves more interesting and more worldly, I suppose. And if a byproduct of that is that mom and dad get a little bit more time to not have to deal with teenager-ish stuff, then, you know, so be it, I think. I don't know. I'm actually years away from the teenager thing, but I teach teenagers, and so I'm concerned for that window of my life where I'm with kids who are adolescents all day and then come home to adolescent kids. At the very least, now they're like different spheres of development, so you can kind of shift gears a little bit. When it's all just one big mass of 12 to 13 year old, I don't know. Things might be a little more stressful, but for now we're going to enjoy that it is summer vacation and my kids are small and still fairly compliant, I suppose.
Yeah, take what you can get, I'm sure.
Yeah. All right, maybe we should talk some baseball. You think that might be why people tuned in?
I don't know. I will
at this point.
I will
they probably don't.
That.
They know the first 5 minutes is not going to be about baseball. All right, we're going to try and focus throughout this episode on kind of the rookies, the youngsters, recent call-ups, and try and make some sense of all of that. So to warm up, this is our new segment. We're calling it the warm-up. Let's talk about a couple of people here. You want to talk specifically about O'Neill Cruz. Is that right? Or is there anybody else in this bucket that you kind of helps to illustrate your point?
You know, Riley Green did just get called up, and I'm sure he's going to stick. The extenuating circumstances with him being like injured and then rehabbed and then right back up, and us lacking some data and also some lacking, I don't know, you want to call it like baseball politics data? Do you want to call whatever you wanted to talk about with the call up delays? He doesn't really fit in. So he's kind of like there, but he's not there for what obviously want to talk about. Someone like O'Neill Cruz is a centerpiece of a show's discussion for a reason these days. He's really good, and he has been really good. So like Riley Green obviously wasn't very good at baseball in late April because, you know, you need feet for that. So I don't know that there are any other obvious names.
Okay, well, then let's jump in with O'Neill Cruz and talk about what's the deal with O'Neill Cruz.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to start in a weird place with this.
Well, good, because I just started with a weird voice. So, you know, there's that.
really fitting there. Rob Silver actually pulled up a really interesting kind of like sort of data point, which I didn't like realize it was as interesting as it was at first. He was comparing the like WRC plus projections from the bat and from Seamer for Cruz, which were way, way, way off from each other. He's in about 125 from Seamer, and I think 91 from the bat, which that's a lot. Now, we've talked preseason a bit about how the bat is, really, really not that into prospects, and how Seamer can be really, really into prospects. So it's a big gap, and it's kind of funny.
It's also across an important line, right?
What do you mean by that exactly?
So we're talking about 100, right? Am I misinterpreting what you're talking about?
Right. Yeah. It's what WRC plus, right? So yeah, 25% better than league average versus 9% worse. It's a big gap.
Right. So it's not just that was my point. Sorry if I was being unclear. Okay, yeah. But like it's like 30 points, but it's not like 150 to 120 where he's still gonna be better than average. It's the difference between being like decently better than average or worse than average. That's an important 30 point range there,
right? And I think that was a big part of Rob Silver's point that he made, where he, and I don't think he was really saying that he believed this, but at least kind of like saying it out loud because it was a within the statistical realm of possibility, that the Pirates saw O'Neill Cruz as maybe more the person that the bat thought he was. And I thought that was kind of funny as a thing to say. He was doing that on purpose, obviously.
Yeah.
But my gut reaction was like, is that bad by the bat standards for rookies? And it led me down this like small rabbit hole of like looking up a bunch of different top prospects like Seamer and also bat projections preseason to kind of see where a bunch of people fell. And like that 35-ish point gap was considerably bigger than a lot of the other prospects that we were potentially hoping to be good fantasy contributors and also real life baseball contributors this year. The only other player who was like in that same stratosphere was like Seiya Suzuki, who was projected for like a 140 by Seamer and like 110-ish by the bat, which like, you know, pretty big. So it was definitely the case then that if 20 was about average, this was a person that there was like room for more disagreement on. But also, we all kind of expect him to be really good. And I thought that was kind of funny leading into like, we actually haven't seen him at the big league level this year. Is it possible that he could, you know, like fail to impress and he came up? So with that said,
to be fair, right? I think we've seen a large uptick in the last couple of years of these can't miss blue chippers coming up and just not being great, not only right away, but over extended periods of time, names that we've said 100 times, Kelnick and Kirillov, people in that realm, even I think we'll get to Torkelson later, but maybe our expectations of immediate impact have been so skewed by the Juan Sotos of the world that we expect everybody to be able to just come up and be amazing and stay amazing. And look at Cody Bellinger. He came up, he was really good. He had a tough year. He was amazing in was it year 3, I think, right? And ever since then, he's been, who is Cody Bellinger? So we know that baseball is really, really hard. We know that everybody who gets to the major league level is really, really good at the game. And so the margins of difference between those who are excellent and those who are just not, especially earlier in their careers, can be fairly razor thin until they get their feet mm-hmm. underneath them and get the opportunity to get the at-bats. And, you know, then other teams are going to get the book and get more of that data that's readily available at the major league level. And then can the player adjust? There's so many things that go on. My first curiosity, and you can either answer this or you can punt it to later, because if it, I don't want it to interfere with any of what you're going to say, is what is it about Cruz's game and Suzuki's game that might be leading these algorithms to have vastly different outputs? That's my curiosity. What is the input that is so different that the output is so different, or are the inputs similar but the weights are vastly different inside those algorithms? Is speed overvalued or undervalued in one system versus the next? What could possibly cause these two systems, because they're not universally that far apart on players, right? That's the point. And so
they are and they aren't. Yeah.
I know that they have discrepancies, right? But to your point, these 30-point swings are more the extreme. So what is it about these players that is causing that? Or is it just dumb coincidence that it happens to be these two guys? That's my first curiosity. I don't even know if you even posited an answer, but.
Yeah, that's actually something that we probably can answer pretty easily. The bat just kind of assumes that there's going to be a rougher transition. Like, it's an across the board, rookies are not projected well by the bat, and
so it's the input guess is lower.
Right. That is, like,
I don't mean guess is like a negative. I'm not knocking it. They're all educated guesses. It's a hard thing to do. I get that, but so it's an input thing.
Yeah. It's the way it's built. It's doing its job as intended. Now, if you're wondering why those guys are the most extreme, like, I pulled up the tweet that I did from the other day, so I can, like, see my own data. Just want to be clear about where this is. Torkelson was projected for 125/99. That's like a 25-point gap. Julio Rodriguez was only 15 points apart, 123 versus 108. Stephen Kwan, 117.96, about 20. Juan Yepes, 116.95, so that's about 20. Adley Rutschman is 109.94, so that's about 15. And then Riley Green, 107.87, so about 20.
A lot of guys across that 100 marker. So, the bat really kind of expects rookies, it seems, to not be as good as replacement, right, in their first years, in their debut seasons.
That's not replacement, I should remind you. That's league average. So, like, replacement is going to be somewhere in, like, the 60s, 70s, 80s range. Like, 60s, 70s range, I think. Like, they are worse than league average.
Okay. All right. So, I said that wrong. And for fantasy purposes, though, that you're also not rostering a lot of those guys at the low end too, so that makes a difference. But either way, it does seem as though the bat is expecting rookies to be below average. I'll say it. That's a more accurate way of saying it, right?
Yeah, and actually, I want to say for fantasy purposes, like in 12s and 15s, replacement level might be about right, steals depending and stuff like that. A lot of guys who are on the wire are going to have WRC plus in the 90s in a 12 or 15 format, or a 12 format, I should say. You're not off.
Yeah. I'm just saying that it's different looking at league average versus replacement level versus fantasy replacement level are not necessarily all the same thing. So anyway, I totally derailed where you were going with this, with O'Neill Cruz and then my silly question. So I, I the the reason we talk about this, I guess, is to talk about what is it with the rookies over the last couple of years that may have been contributing factors to maybe what we could posit is delayed development. And so like the first question you have here is what elements of the pandemic maybe have impacted what's gone on. So maybe elaborate on that a little bit.
Yeah. So I feel like I've heard from a few people a sort of like rookie development hypothesis. A guy on a team that you might occasionally watch, I guess, Cheer Downs is a guy who comes to mind for me for this. And not in a good way. I'm kind of like sad to see him as someone who is like a really good in a lot of people's out of the park simulations, but not necessarily trending towards good things in real life. He's like headed into his second consecutive season being below the Mendoza line in the minor leagues. That's not something you'd want to be the case for like the blue chip guy that you got back for a Mookie. And I don't think that there's any amount of like, you know, blame you want to head his way. It sounds like things are rough as a minor leaguer these days. And that's, I mean, like, blame if you want, but like probably a bad person. And that's kind of like the thing that we're putting forward is this hypothesis that the 2020 season being just a wreck. And then, you know, what was kind of like a chaotic, I think, minor league season last year. And then let's also just throw in like the maybe chaos of like off-season instruction for people who were on the 40 man, especially like Jeter Downs, really just kind of contribute to an environment where like consistent opportunities to play, consistent interaction with the coaches, all of the things that you would want in a, like a coherent system of like prospect growth haven't necessarily been in place. Now, I'm not like a scout person, obviously, but the whole point of today's show then is to look at how the data that we have available to us on like the major league level is kind of bearing out, which, you know, finally gives me a chance to care about things properly. And the idea there isn't that hard to try to track, except for this kind of other thing that we mentioned, which is the new CBA has kind of given different, I don't know, like incentives to play rookies necessarily than in past years, and especially compared to like 2019. So, you know, if you like throw all these eggs together, you get last year, everyone like being kind of like delayed. But also last year, if you were close to the top, there are probably gonna be a bunch of rookies that should have debuted in 2020 who like didn't get an opportunity to. So we get like a way bigger rookie class. We'll get into that a little bit later, especially on the pitching side. So we kind of get this weird stew of it's hard to consistently measure whether this year's rookies are better or worse because everything's just kind of blown up. But on individual cases, you can see where some of these things might play out. So it's very much like a curiosity thing that it's hard to tackle that I think it's worth our time to try to tackle because these are some of the most compelling stories. Like, is the guy that you're hoping becomes the centerpiece of your team going to be able to pan out, and has he had the opportunity to?
Yeah, I think those are huge questions, especially if people have just recently picked them up or have been holding on to them this whole time, depending upon your format and bench depth and all of that, waiting for this moment to arrive where they come up and hopefully have an impact on your team. I would like to just take a moment to pay homage to the fact that you say Mr. Betts's first name as if it rhymes with Wookiee, like from Star Wars. Mookie Betts. Is that how he says it? Have I missed this whole time? Am I wrong?
I don't know. It's entirely possible Mookie. That I'm the one who's wrong. You know,
but then, well, then to be fair to you, though, then I'm looking at the word rookie, which we say like Wookiee.
Oh, yeah.
The English language is baffling. It's impossible. It's very, very difficult. Anyway, again, not what people have tuned in to listen to, but
worth our while though.
We want to take a look now, moving on from the conversation of O'Neill Cruz specifically as like our warm up, and for our numbers of the week segment, look at some actual rookie data broken down by both hitter and pitcher. But before we get into all that juicy, awesome data analysis goodness, we are going to take a very small break.
Hey, Alex Fast here, and thanks for listening to this podcast on the Pitcher List Podcast Network. If you're a fan, consider supporting all of us by getting a PL Plus subscription, where you're going to get an ad-free website and get access to our Discord, where you can talk to all of our podcast hosts and staff. Plus, you can hang out with our incredible Pitcher List community. It's basically a baseball sanctuary year-round for as low as $8 a month. You can sign up at pitcherlist.com/plus, and you're going to get your first month free with promo code podcast. Also, don't forget to check out everything else we do as well, from YouTube videos, live streams, newsletters, off-season articles, TikToks, breakdowns, over 15 baseball podcasts on our network. We can't stop talking about baseball, even during the off-season. So sign up for PL Plus today at pitcherlist.com/plus and use promo code podcast to get your first month free. All right, thanks for listening. Let's get back to the show.
All right, Alexander, we are back. So what is it that we need to be thinking about data-wise around these hitters, these rookie pitchers, and what's the context that makes it all make sense?
So the number this week that I really want to take a look at was the to-date FWAR for our rookie pitchers and hitters. I think it paints an interesting picture, better than just WRC+, which is a number we're also going to take a look at today, to kind of try to answer whether or not the past couple years of prospect development have messed with some people in some interesting ways, before we end up kind of taking stock on a more granular level. So we are not quite halfway, but rapidly approaching the halfway point. Oh my goodness, my search here is just going to fight with me.
That's exactly what you absolutely want while you're in the middle of a thought.
Yeah, yeah, no,
train of thought derailed, right?
Yeah, yeah. So I want to start with a thing that happened last year on the pitching side. So if you're go back to, I'm going to just set arbitrarily the year 2000. I'm sure the 90s, 80s, and all of the other time before that we have nice data for are really interesting. But I feel like it's worth talking about, in a more modern aging curve world, and also in a modern financial world where people kind of get pushed back more and maybe are debuting better, which is a force that we have to kind of in the longer term than just the last 3 years, think about happening. So last year, rookie pitchers pitched for the first time in this millennium over 10,000 innings. They actually hit 12,000. They blew out of the water some of the previous marks. Now, they hit 9,600 innings in 2019, 9,700 innings in 2009. They've been close to that mark, but they went more than 25% beyond what had been the top number of innings pitched. So the total accumulated FWAR for rookie pitchers last year was 62 wins. To date, we are at 10.7. Rookie pitchers have, despite the way that the ball has changed and the game has changed, not seen as big of an ERA drop as the rest of the league. They just generally haven't been as good on the whole, right? There hasn't been those top end stars that really push these totals. It's been a lot of just replacement and level stuff. And that's even considering last year that, a lot of rookies that were being called up were just our starters can't go 200 innings this year. We got to get someone to fill. And you would think that a lot of those unprepared, never seen the majors before, just had a year where they maybe didn't pitch against actual real competition, would have come in and been a disaster. And yet 62 wins is the most for a pitching class since 2012.
Okay, can we back up and break that down just a little bit? So, and we can also test to see how much I remember about how all of these things work as well. So last year, there's a good chance that we probably had a bigger rookie class because the year previous, there were less pitchers who were able to debut, right? Because of the shortened season. So we can expect there to be a larger number of pitchers, rookie pitchers who debuted. So is F4 is an accumulated stat, correct?
Right.
Okay. So it's not inconceivable then, help me if I'm wrong, if I'm on the wrong path here, if the number of pitchers that are rookies increases by 15%, let's say, whatever it was.
I'm going to go with 25%.
Okay, let's say 25%. Then an increase of accumulated F-war amongst rookie pitchers, quote unquote, as a category should also increase at least in a similar fashion, maybe not like completely linearly, but like a 20% increase in F-war accumulation doesn't sound like it would be ridiculous, right?
So I want to give you the case against that thought, and then I'm going to give you reality. My thought is, if you're just going to add in a bunch of extra guys, you're not going to be adding in a bunch of extra good guys. I imagine it's going to be a lot more filler, a lot more of like the quad A types.
But if you've had 2 years worth of good pitchers not be able to make their debut, then maybe they are just as good.
That would make sense. Now, here's the thing. It wasn't a 25% increase in wins. It was almost like, I'm going to call it like 30 to 40% more than many of the previous years. So they seemed like they were pretty good by many metrics. Now, one of the things we have to kind of answer that question, and why I thought this was kind of a fun exercise beyond just the answer questions about your team way, is, you know, I'm doing this all in Fangraphs because I like F-War more than B-War, but also because I just kind of like the ways that you can break down some splits and stuff like that. This is a great opportunity to use their like plus stats button. So you get like ERA plus or ERA minus as a concept here. And last year's rookie pitchers, we're going to talk about this year shortly, were like pretty good by those measures in a lot of ways. Their command was better if you're looking at walks per nine plus or walk percent plus. They're more like the 110 mark, which is like 10, 11% more walk rate, like that, just a little bit more than average, whereas typically they're in like the 20s range, so their walk numbers are better. Overall, they're like the ERA minus for the cohort was a 108, which was the best in a handful of years back to hold on a second, I gotta make sure I have this sorted correctly. I got the wrong number for ERA plus minus. They were about the same, actually. I had it like sorted a bit, but they were like, they added all that extra volume and they were about as good ERA wise. Okay. So yeah, I think then you would say that your hypothesis that they were able to backfill with about like an equally talented sort of like number of people because of the pandemic would play out. They just happen to be better at not walking people as well.
Well, here's the other thing too. And this is just completely hypothesizing, like you said.
Right.
But that's last science. Year, there were also, I think anecdotally, maybe I'm wrong, maybe the data says I'm way off, but a lot more opportunities for middle relief pitchers to earn the win, right? And go in and have like positive stat outcomes because starting pitchers weren't going as long or as deep into games, all of those kinds of things. Would any of that play into a like an F-war outcome?
I would think that the most likely way that shows up is like if they're getting deployed less as just go earn me a bunch of innings, but we get a lot more like relief-ish appearances. You know, pitchers are a little bit better in relief. Maybe that could have buoyed some of it as well. We just get like more two-inning outings where people could be like their best version of themselves. And I think that might be part
and
of it.
Get a two-inning win, right, as a stat in their stat line because they come in after the starter went three or four.
You know what?
I don't know.
I haven't thought about like actual real wins versus like war wins, right?
But that factors in, doesn't it?
I don't think it does. No, because it's because F-war is basically just FIP. It's just like FIP extrapolated out until like how many innings you pitched and like what league average is.
Okay. That said, so that's a good distinction. I don't mind being wildly wrong about thinking that like your level of success is factored into that, because I think it's an important distinction for people to understand what's actually feeding that number.
Hilariously,
to understand the discrepancies.
They came within two games of having a winning record, which would they have. Rookie pitchers have not had an overall winning record since or ever. Maybe I'm going to like scroll through here with my eyes and see if I can
maybe
catch
ever.
One. Yeah, definitely not in the past 20 years. Doesn't look like they have. No. Oh, 2020. I guess, which doesn't count.
That's tough.
So that's the only other year.
There's a lot of interesting things. So I guess the overall point is not necessarily to be in the weeds with specifically like, let's explain how many more wins they got, either real life wins or F4 win values. More to say that there seems to be a lot more variables introduced into trying to understand what happened last year because of delayed development, because of an extra year of having to wait. Maybe you have extra talent that comes in a single year because it didn't have a chance to come in the year prior. It just, mm-hmm. just as examples, I'm sure there are many more elements at play there that could be affecting that. And on the other side too, I mean, were hitters properly ramped up early on? Did they mm-hmm. experience mm-hmm. a little bit of fatigue as the year went on because of how 2020 shaped up? I don't know. There's just seems, and then on top of all of that, right, is the human element that we have such a hard time trying to quantify. So I don't know. This is absolutely fascinating for me because I like the idea of like trying to figure out both through the numbers and the narratives what really went on. But in reality, it wasn't just any one thing going on. It was a whole lot of things happening at once. And how much of that can we really peel back? How many layers of that onion can we really peel back? And the answer mm-hmm. is some, mm-hmm. probably not all.
Right. And I think this is where it kind of gets important to get to the granular level for like this year's rookie crop. One of the things that kind of stands out on the pitching side, and you know, I don't always think of pitchers first, but I think this was like the place where like the numbers kind of like made me think first, is that we haven't really had a dominant rookie pitcher by a WAR standpoint. Now, we've had some people who look really good, and I think you can push back to a degree. Like Mackenzie Gore's been pretty good for a few moments. Spencer Strider looks credible, right? But like they haven't accumulated that many wins so far, or maybe like wins, not in terms of like W's for your fantasy team, but like wins worth of value. I think right now, I gotta pull this one more time again. I keep doing a poor job of that. We're sitting at about like 1.2 is the top end of that for pitchers. Oh, I can see how I can do that faster. Yeah, we're looking at 1.2 for both Strider and Gore. And Joe Ryan is the only other pitcher with one win of value so far. Overall, among pitchers, the best in terms of FWAR are sitting at about 3.3 for Kevin Gausman. Basically, we don't have a rookie pitcher within the top 35 of FWAR so far this year, which definitely is kind of unusual. You know, we've had people come up and be really excellent. And Alek Manoah was definitely one of the best pitchers right from the jump last year and like ended up very high on one of these lists. It wouldn't surprise me if someone makes his debut and sneaks into the top 35 at the end of the season, but yeah, it's quite unusual in that regard. And that's kind of like the thing that I want to think about as like a thing when we think about our like opinions of the class as a whole, opinions of the year and what it's done for rookies. We're not going to think about this like large sample size, here's what the average is sort of way. We're going to remember the top end guys and think about where they fell historically and then maybe a little bit more of the depth. But this is the sort of thing that I think is interesting, is that, you know, where are they? Are they sitting in the minors for some more seasoning because their development was delayed? Or did they come up last year? And I think the answer is yes. And that's kind of just two reasons why Spencer Strider and Mackenzie Gore are like the only people we're really seeing so far.
Yeah, I mean, opportunity is huge. And there's an entire other element. I think you kind of hinted at it, but during the COVID year, they were like, they weren't playing games, right? I mean, they were like in facilities doing, it wasn't anywhere near their regular routine. And mm-hmm. then also the beginning of this year, right? During the lockout and the off season, they weren't allowed in facilities. Correct?
Right. Some of them who weren't on the 40-man were like able to do some of that stuff, but a lot of those people haven't been called up.
Right. So if you're looking at the people who usually come up in our impact, they're generally on the 40-man, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, not like, a hard and fast hard rule, but...
It's just less likely that they would get called up like early on, right? Because then you would need a DFA someone to make space on the 40 man or move someone to the 60-day IL. And you know, like there's some simple ways for that to like happen, but it's just less likely.
I guess
what
I'm getting
quickly
at is a lot of those guys who are just about to make debuts are probably already on that roster, right?
Right.
If you're not, then you're vulnerable. So they were mm-hmm. O'Neal Cruz was probably not able to do his off-season regimen with the team, right?
He was called up last year, so he's been on the 40 man.
Right. That's kind of what I'm normally we're looking at people who have had 3 to 5 years of very normal development from draft to debut.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a group of players who have been impacted twice in very significant ways. I know that the lockout wasn't super long, but it was at a very pivotal point. And when you're talking about guys who have been veterans and played for a bunch of years, they could probably approximate what they would normally do or find a facility where they could, you know, go through their motions. These mm-hmm. kids are still learning what all that's about. So right. There's a lot of opportunity here in the last 3 years for those players to have gotten somewhat the short end of the stick on all of these things, and that compounds. So I think it's fair to say that even coming up and being impactful for this year for a lot of these guys is a big deal in terms of actual baseball. For your fantasy team, that's frustrating. Totally. If you invested a lot in O'Neal Cruz on draft day and expected him to be up and stay up and, you know, play a lot for not a great team and you know, hit the ball really, really hard and steal a bunch of bases, then you're frustrated for sure. You're frustrated, especially if you've held on to him. But in terms of expectations for what this year could bring, there's still a lot of season left to play. There's a chance that O'Neal Cruz at the end of this year is going to be accumulated an amazing stat line in a prorated sense, right? But I think that our expectations of these kids coming up, having dealt with what they've dealt with in multiple mm-hmm. ways, on top of them being rookies, which is difficult in its own way, mm-hmm. maybe we were expecting too much. And maybe we do that often, again, because a handful of guys have shown that it's possible to come up and be immediately amazing. We all expect all of them to come up and be immediately amazing, and baseball's hard.
Yeah, I think another part of this is also that you mentioned him earlier with an intention to get back to him. You know, the top end names of the class are like Torkelson, Witt, Julio Rodriguez. Two of those have hit, and Spencer Torkelson is the other one. And yeah. Adley Rutschman hasn't been great so far, but people just ignore catchers. So I'm going to ignore catchers, even though that's not quite fair to him. I think Julio Rodriguez and Spencer Torkelson are kind of like the two sides of the same coin in terms of like how the past couple of years have caused havoc. We kind of knew that Rodriguez was going to be kind of fast. I think we've mentioned this before. Him being on essentially a 50 steal pace this year is nuts. And then Spencer Torkelson is on a 10 home run pace this year. Like, that's nuts as well. And I kind of want to take a closer look at like some of the things that make prospects a little bit more unpredictable. You actually called attention to this earlier, and then I kind of let it slide till tonight. Like, the why is O'Neal Cruz like hard to pin down for these projection systems? Why would, say, a Suzuki hard to pin down for some of these projection systems? It's kind of like a separate question, but I want to make sure I answer too. Like, what makes these guys easier to put within a band versus harder is a really interesting question. And one of the things I want to call attention to then is basically like how you strike out as a concept. Torkelson has so far this year a 25% strikeout rate. He has been walking a fair amount of time. He's like roughly 11%. But like that hasn't been quite good enough, right? In the past, he's been like pretty excellent by some of those metrics. You know, he's been like a really, really excellent walker. Essentially, I love using the word walk as like a verb in the baseball sense because it feels so odd, right? It's really funny to me. But yeah, like last year in the minors across three teams, this is harder for me to see. Yeah, he struck 114 times and walked 77 times. That's a pretty good ratio. 114 strikeouts over 500 PAs is like, yeah, just a little bit more than 20 something percent. I could be looking this up much more easily than I am. And so that's gone up. One of the things that typically these systems kind of struggle with, and Torque wasn't a guy that struggled with as much in this way, he's just been unable to hit the ball hard, is the more you're swinging, strike rate is high. For O'Neill Cruz, he's 6'7". He's got a ton of power, but those long levers, as you like to say, are hard to control, and you're going to strike out some. Even Aaron Judge, who's extremely good, is going to strike out at a fair clip. And he's just like probably about the best you can be at not striking out for being a behemoth of a human being. So like, that's a reason why you'd expect some of these systems to struggle with people. We have a hard time pinning down like the Nolan Gormans of the world because like he strikes out a fair bit. You know, I think Jesus Sanchez was a guy that we're a little bit worried about in this regard. And that's going to cause uncertainty. You're not always sure how that's going to kind of flow across. Interestingly, a name that I don't think I pulled earlier is Alec Thomas. And there's an interesting article or interview he gave earlier this year about like how people were attacking him on the major league levels in ways that pitchers in the minors weren't attacking him. And like they weren't just going after his perceived weaknesses. They were almost creating new ones just by going after things he wasn't expecting. You know, Thomas has been pretty good this year. He's adapted reasonably well. That's taken some time, but he's kind of found what he's looking for, and he's on like a basically like 2015 fantasy pace. Like if you prorate it, he'd be like definitely a sort of guy that would be like a $10+ hitter in like a 12 team league. Like he's been good. And it's taken a second, but he's kind of gotten there. We are right now in the time of the season where the guys who've been up for a while, we can start to like think about whether or not like they've have made some adjustments and aren't going to just get immediately figured out. You know, I think Adolis Garcia last year was starting to come off as an initial hot streak and was starting to look quite vulnerable by about this point. Now, he's had a great second year, but it took him a bit, right? So if we're looking at a guy like Torkelson, I definitely want to kind of call attention to the same sorts of things that we saw last year for Andrew Vaughn, where you start off in a rough place and you want to see how things change, how you yourself adapt over time.
Yeah.
I've been checking in on Torkelson quite a bit. You know?
Yeah. I think a good way to think about this in terms of fantasy, and we don't have to think about this only in terms of fantasy, but is like, who are the buys right now? Who are these names that people might be soured on because they haven't come up and been really, really good that you're probably not going to get for free, right? Because people invested in them and want them to be good and are going to be frustrated with the fact that they're not good. They're not going to want to just give them away, but maybe you get them for 90 cents on the dollar and that's worth doing. That's an interesting way, I think, of looking at this. And you telling that story about Alec Thomas coming up and the pitchers creating weaknesses. I don't think we spend enough time talking about just how much we're asking of 19, 20, 21 year old human beings who are exceptional at what they do because they've probably always been the best of the people that they've played with, whether that was when they were on their 13 year old, American Legion teams or Little League teams, whether that was their high school team, even their college teams, right? They've been the best. They've devoted themselves to being the best. They have done the same thing and built their skill set up to a point way beyond what other human beings could ever hope to do. Then they get to the major leagues and have to figure it out all over again. They have to change what's worked for them for their entire 20 years, and they have to change it. They have to figure out how to get good at something they didn't even know they had to be good at after having been the best of the best at this thing that they do their whole lives. That is not easy. It's just not an easy thing physically, mentally, emotionally. And you're asking it of kids who are not fully matured, whose brains are not fully developed. It's really amazing. It's very easy for us to think about these situations in terms of statistics and performance and swing and miss data and all of that. we forget to talk about how it's a 20-year-old. A 20-year-old kid who can't legally buy alcohol that is supposed to go onto this main stage and just be amazing and awesome. So I think in terms of thinking about buying low, what's the more likely outcome? That the 20-year-old who's been amazing at this and scouts have been drooling over for years figures it out, or that everybody was wrong?
Right.
Eventually, it's way more likely that they're going to figure it out. Maybe they're not going to be the next Mike Trout that everybody was talking about, but they don't have to be to have value and be meaningful contributors to your fantasy squad.
I feel like that's a hard pill to swallow conceptually. And I really wonder about how they conceptualize of that. I don't know how you just choose to like make the like really small incremental choices whenever you're probably faced with it feels like a monumental and crushing defeat pretty much every day, if not every other day in some of these cases. Like, and it's those sorts of choices I feel like that I'm looking for if I want to like see if there's anything that they're doing differently. You know, like a nice thing to do, like I'm going to pull up like a Fangraphs rolling chart here for Torkelson, and I want to click a lot of like the different choice adjacent stats, and then maybe a couple other ones that might be mechanical adjacent stats to see if there are things that are being tweaked with. Now I imagine like something like swinging strike rate is both a product of like what you're swinging at, how you're swinging at it, and what you're being offered, right? But like out like O-swing chase rate sort of stuff like that, that's a lot going to be just influenced by your choices. Are you being more disciplined? I remember at the very beginning of the year, Torkelson was kind of notoriously just not chasing a whole lot, trying to get walks and kind of suffering at times because of that. So that's something that I wanted to know how he would adjust. And so, you know, that's what it is. His O-swing rate, by the way, has gone up as the year's gone down. He was sitting about 20 to start the year, and it's gone up at peak to about 33%, kind of leveled off more in the high 20s now. So he is trying to be more aggressive as a guy who probably should have some power. Now, mind you, is trying to hit the ball at all a good idea if you're in Detroit? Maybe not. Park's too big. You know, maybe you should just walk no matter what. But it's a separate concept.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
I've also been wanting to check in, though. It's like, what's happened to his swinging strike rate? Well, he had that number go up, but as he's continued to swing, it's kind of gone back down, which shows up to a degree, I think, in his like zone contact rate kind of coming back up from like an like a middle of like the so far season kind of like dipping as he started to swing more. So I think in general, you're seeing someone who's getting used to the profile of what's being like offered to him and how he needs to go after it.
Adapting what into what he needs to be to survive in this climate, and then the skills will follow. I mean, if he's good and talented, which we know he is, that should follow. There are it's very unlikely that these are going to be the next Hiras, right? That doesn't happen.
No, absolutely
all that
not.
Much. Yeah. That's a super outlier case. And so, you know, I don't know. If you're thinking that Torkelson is going to be bad at baseball, you're probably wrong. Is he going to be good enough right now to help your team? And if you've invested in him, are you allowed to be a little frustrated? Sure. Totally. Yeah. But that doesn't mean that Torkelson is you write him off. Just whatever.
Right.
It's just
right.
Silly.
Yeah. And that definitely shows up in, you know, his strikeout rate has like gone from considerably above average for his first 35 games to pretty comfortably below average for his next 35 ish games. Right. He's been, basically, since like, you know, like for the past month, been a 20% strikeout rate guy. That'll play. Like that straight up is just pretty
sure
good if you're someone like him.
Figure out how to manage your swing and miss, and then we'll worry about when you make contact, making sure it's hard contact. It makes perfect sense to me that this is like the progression that a team or a hitting coach would be taking somebody through to adapt to their new environment. Okay, well, this is where we're seeing the big problem area. Let's work on that. Okay, now we've reduced that down to a place where we're comfortable. Now let's work on the next thing. All right, that has made more sense. You're doing a better job of identifying pitches as they come in, right? now let's work on making solid contact because you're better able to identify the pitch and put a solid swing on it. But if you try and do all those things at once, you're still going to, you're going to overwhelm yourself and be mired in that struggle.
You know, it's exactly like that when you look at his, and this isn't something that I normally cite, but hey, I'm on FanGraphs. I have some rolling charts. I may as well use it. They're hard percent, not, which is not like the same as like the exit velocity based hard hit percent. It's something funny. It's not something I typically cite, but like if you overlay that with his strikeout rate, he was seeing his like hard percent drop off as his strikeouts dropped off. He seemed like he was to a degree willing to choke up or something like that. And of late, he's been hitting the ball harder. Now, he's been grounding out a lot, which is a kind of concerning thing. You typically do with a flatter swing path, make more contact, but less desirable contact. So, you know, that was a problem.
Also saw that be a problem for Vladdy and Bohm, and they've been able to kind of.
Exactly.
Well, certainly. Yeah, right. I mean, it's so again, I think that's the steps. I know you hate talking about golf, but when you look at like a golf swing, those are the things, I don't know what pros are doing this, but those are the things that you do, okay? Like, let's fix your grip because that's part of the reason you're slicing the ball all the time. And it's going to feel weird and you're going to hit the ball bad for a while until you get used to that grip. Okay, well, now that you've fixed the grip, you're getting on top of the ball too much. So we're going to change something else. You can't do it all at once. If you try and focus on 10 things at one time in your swing, whether it's a stationary golf ball on a tee in front of you or a pitch coming in at 92 that's darting and dancing all over the place, you can't be thinking about 10 things at once. Even thinking about one thing can be a distraction, and you have to focus on that one thing until it becomes muscle memory, and then you don't have to think about it anymore. It makes perfect sense to me that this is a learning process for him, and we're actually watching the evolution of a hitter at the major league level unfold before our eyes. Again, that's frustrating if you want him to be performing for your fantasy team, but I think it's encouraging that he's responding to the teaching is what it looks like, at least.
Yeah. So I've decided to like take myself to a different site and take a look at what his rolling hard hit rate has been. And you know, it was at the beginning of the year when he was barely making contact. For the first 50 PA or so, he was sitting in like the 50 and then 45 rate, which is like good, but like absolutely necessary to be at that point if you're not doing much else than strikeout. And then he started striking out less, and the hard hit rate goes down to like significantly below average. We're talking like a 50 PA stretch where it's in the 20s. That is really bad. So either way, like the hard contact rate was probably for both of these different combinations of things, not good. His hard hit rate starting to climb back up. And, you know, I'm sure right now, if he's been for the past 50 PAs, let's call it, a like 35% hard hit rate guy with a 20% strikeout rate and a 10% walk rate. So that means he's putting the ball in play 70% of the time. And of that 70%, you know, like a third of that is hard contact. That's still like 24 or so percent, which is not great, like 23 or so. But you add on an above average walk rate and you have someone who has a shot at being on base just a little bit less than league average. And then you add the Detroit of it all and it goes down. But like, he's also done that, and that's good.
And he's done it in less than half a season.
Right. We saw Vaughn make this transformation last year.
Yeah. Right. His hard hit rate comes up a few more percentage points and some more of those are line drives instead of ground balls. And all of a sudden you're talking about a completely different player in terms of his contribution and his offensive output. So it sounds to me at least like we're both kind of making the case for if somebody's willing to sell torque to you for 80, 90 cents on the dollar, you should do that.
Yeah. This is not someone who's
dynasty. Dynasty. Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah. I don't know actually where you would even want to try to acquire someone like this in redraft because.
Well, that's why I'm making that very clear. It was clear that that's what we're kind of talking about. But if not, I wanted to make sure I said it out loud. All right. I'm going to ask you one more question. It's a two-parter. It's along the same lines. And I am putting you a little bit on the spot, but this will be what takes us to the end of the show. What would be maybe another buy low and maybe a sell high because there's some hype on a performance that you don't believe in as much from a rookie?
Okay. If we're, I'm going to like,
you could do that in whichever order you'd like.
I'm going to try to gauge what you might even be interested in this as best I can. But I feel like my mental like understanding of what a good rookie player is sometimes distorted. I feel like you have to like fully cross off people like Bobby Witt Jr., like Julio Rodriguez in terms of buying, because who's going to sell them to you?
Yeah, right, right. Right. No, right. Like earlier in the year, we were talking about Kwan, right? As like a very clear sell high if there's somebody who is going to want him because of the way he was playing. More along those lines. Somebody that maybe is doing something that's a little unsustainable or at least unlikely, or a name that we haven't heard of. So maybe it's just some luck and a short sample size. Anything. It doesn't have to be, you know, we're not going to come back in 6 months and decide whether or not you live or die based on your prediction here. That would be extreme.
Yeah, I feel like he's probably performing better than people in the market is kind of giving him credit for. Guys, probably Alec Thomas, if I'm going to try to go acquire a rookie this year. I don't think he's got the sort of like word of mouth excellence. And like, you know, if you picked him up in redraft, you're probably willing to part with him. I'd figure he gets better. So that's a name that comes to mind. Like, Christopher Morel has gotten, I feel like, a whole lot more attention because he's got more steals, but he's striking out 28% of the time. Alec Thomas is striking out less than 20% of the time with a walk rate that's about league average. That's leading to a 336 OBP through this year or through today. And I think that can go up. Like, that's a guy who's going to get himself good opportunities. And I don't think Arizona's bad. That's going to hurt him as much. So that's a guy that I'm pretty interested in conceptually. It's also just like fun. I like that. I feel like a similar sort of, maybe the hype hasn't been just like high enough, sort of guys, MJ Melendez, but I could be wrong on that. Maybe people do evaluate him correctly. Because again, I always think that you should get people who are catcher eligible. And, you know, if for some reason the guy who has him doesn't understand what a gem he has in that, you know, go make the market make sense. In terms of people who I'd want to sell high on, I'm not sure. I feel like I should still be somewhat scared by Nolan Gorman's 32% strikeout rate. Like, I should. Like, his batting average and his OBP shouldn't be this sustainable. And I think there are a couple different mildly red flags. He's been playing pretty well, but I'm worried that some things could end up not continuing as well as they have been. That's a fear I have on that part, that there's a lot of room for a bad month here. Especially given just the number of bodies in St. Louis they have and the capacity for, you know, some playing time to get stretched in a funny way. So that's a thing I'm kind of concerned about. That said, I do think he's good and he can probably survive that high strikeout rate to a degree because what he's doing to baseballs when they are, you know, hit. If he's hitting the ball, like, actually right now, about 60% of the time he's putting the ball in play. Like, that's enough at some point.
Sure. And again, to the point we were just making, something that can be improved upon when you're talking about somebody this young, and the sample size it's large enough for us to be able to have a conversation, but it's certainly small compared to a career. So,
right. He's got 100 PA so far.
Yeah. We have to be really, really careful about labeling people, at this stage of their career, one way or the other, I think, and just like putting a stamp on them and writing them off, or just being so in love with them that there's no chance at all that they could come back to earth. Any other players that you want to mention quick before we have to go?
Yeah, I mean, we haven't talked about Adley, which is kind of criminal. He actually also only has 100 PA and he strike out under 20% of the time. The power should be there. His BABIP's been bad. I think that's the sort of guy that, like, especially in redraft, if you have the capacity to, like, we're talking like deep one catcher redraft or shallow two catcher redraft, he's the sort of guy that I'd be really interested in acquiring or, you know, looking into in some sort of ways. That profile makes sense. I'm also just like fully ignoring, by the way, CJ Abrams as a quantity for buying and selling, because he just got called up and I don't really know. His strikeout rate's been really, you know, good. the steals weren't there in his 72 PAs that he's had so far. I feel like that has to change. But I'm kind of curious there. So there's just some people I'm kind of watching in this sort of, I want to see how it pans out for the rest of the season, and I'm not placing any chips in any direction just yet sort of way.
Well, that all sounds pretty reasonable to me. And that is going to bring us to the end of our episode. Alexander, thanks once again for joining me. And if you could remind the people where they could find us.
Well, they can find you on Twitter at @TheCorkedMatt. I'm on Twitter at @Chase_Rate. And most importantly, you can find our podcast on Twitter at Dugout Study Hall, where you can send us some questions. Please be sure to subscribe to the Pitcherless podcast feed if you haven't done that already. Leave us a good review if you can be so kind. And if you're not already, please consider becoming a PL Plus member so that you can harass us on the PL Discord. And that's it for me.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll catch you next time.